And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I've been reading now for about a month, titled The 57 Bus. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled The Bear Who Loved to Dance. And then it's Princess Arabella is a Big Sister, Leo and the Pink Marker, Coogie the Dumpster Cat, Raven's Ribbons, A Hug on the Wind, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Thunder Maestro. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled The Bear Who Loved to Dance. He practiced in his bedroom every day. Bear wanted to dance with the other animals, but he was very clumsy. Bear tried ballet, but all the giraffes just laughed at him. Bend, whirl, twirl. Thud, thud, stomp. You're not graceful enough for ballet, they mocked. So Bear tried break dance. Break, break, break. But the monkeys simply giggled. You're not bendy enough for break dance, they sniggered. Bear tried tap dance too. Tap, but the rhinos grumbled at Bear. You're not quick enough for tap dancer, they scoffed. Then Bear tried swing. But Zebra wasn't happy. You're too strong for swing, she cried. Bear even tried tortoises laughed at Bear, too. Splosh! Poor Bear couldn't seem to do anything right. Until one day, he noticed the poster. First ever ice skating competition for bears only. Join now, Pond in the Woods, 12 Oaksing. 10 out of 10, they cheered. Well done, Bear. Awesome. Hooray. Bear won first place in the competition, and he was given a shiny gold medal. And all the other animals learned that dancing on ice was not easy at all. Princess Arabella is a big sister. Princess Arabella is playing with her ball. She throws it into the air and bounces it up and down. She shakes her curly head. It's a bit boring, she thinks, playing by myself all the time. Wouldn't it be nicer to have a little brother or a little sister? Someone you could always play with? Mom, Dad, I don't want to be an only child anymore. Can you get a little brother or sister for me tomorrow? Then we can play together. Well, the king and queen smiled and asked, which would you prefer, a little brother or a little sister? Well, that's a hard question, thinks Princess Arabella. A little brother or a little sister? They both sound like good fun. A few days later, Princess Arabella is visiting Prince Minmon and his sister, Princess Layla. Mimmon's mom hands out sweets. Mmm, yum, yum. It's really nice having a little sister around, thinks Arabella. Suddenly, Princess Layla grabs some of her brother's sweets. You've got more than me, she yells. I haven't. Give them back, screams Mimmon. All the sweets fall onto the floor. Maybe a little brother would be better, thinks Princess Arabella. A few weeks later, Arabella goes to play with Princess Ling and her three little brothers. They decide to do a jigsaw puzzle with 100 pieces. Now there's just one last piece missing. They can't find the last jigsaw puzzle piece. I can see it! I can see it! Cries Princess Ling. So now I can put in the last piece. No, the three brothers all shout together. We want to do it. They run towards the last piece, and one of them slips and falls right on top of the puzzle. Now the puzzle is in 100 pieces again. I wish I didn't have little brothers, yells Ling. Maybe I should ask for a big sister instead. Arabella thinks to herself. A couple months later, Princess Arabella is playing dress-up at Princess Sophie's house. Your big sister always wears such pretty dresses, says Arabella with a sigh. Why don't we try them on, says Princess Sophie. Shouldn't we ask her first, replies Arabella, but Sophie is already diving into Princess Stella's wardrobe. Princess Arabella and Princess Sophie admire themselves in the mirror. These dresses are so much prettier than the things in the dressing-up box. But then Princess Stella storms into the room. What are you doing with my clothes? She shouts. Mom, Sophie's playing with my things again. It's another couple of months later now. Princess Arabella still isn't sure. Would she prefer a little sister or a little brother? Actually, being an only child is pretty good, thinks Princess Arabella. Wake up, Arabella, wake up. It's time. Come and see. With sleepy eyes, Princess Arabella goes into her mom and dad's bedroom. Look, sweetheart, says the queen, a little brother and a little sister. Congratulations, Arabella. You're a big sister now. Leo and the Pink Marker. It was another gray, dusty day in the scrapyard. Leo sighed. Mom and Mama had told him to play quietly while they worked. All afternoon. He grabbed his favorite pink marker and started coloring. But pretty soon, he had scribbled through his entire coloring book. Coloring outside the lines was fun. Leo had a great idea. He found a nearby rock and drew a big smiley face on it. Holy moly, what a color! That dusty old rock looks so fun now. But it could look even better. Leo colored the whole rock pink. Leo looked around for something else that would look good in pink. He saw the mailbox. Just a small splash of color really livened up the whole place. Leo colored the front door of their trailer, and Mama's tall boots, and their cat, Hambone. Leo sat in the driveway, admiring his work. His eyes wandered over to Mom's truck. A pink truck would be so cool, but Mom's truck was definitely off limits. Surely she wouldn't be mad if he colored this old broken car instead. It was only junk after all. Goodness gracious, what a marvel. Leo looked around the faded, crumbling piles surrounding him and got to work. He colored the rusty old van, the crunched-up convertible, and the busted semi. Leo colored and colored and colored. After putting the finishing touches on the magnet crane, he looked up and admired his work. Uh-oh, he may have gotten a bit carried away. Mom and Mama came walking around the corner. Mama was carrying a pair of bright bubblegum boots. Mom was holding a hot pink Hambone. Leo, get down here now! And he goes down from the magnet. Leo, did you color our mailbox pink? Mom asked. Said Leo. Leo, did you color our trailer door pink? Mama asked. Well, you see, Leo began. Leo, Mom exclaimed, did you color the entire scrapyard pink? Not everything, Leo answered. Slowly, he led his mom's to the entrance of the scrapyard. There sat Mom's truck, dusty and gray, just like he left it. Leo's moms stared at the truck silently. Leo braced himself. "Leo," Mom cried, "what on earth were you thinking?" "Leaving my truck such a boring color," Mama smiled. "This is just the refresher this old place needed." They both scooped up Leo and gave him a huge hug. And Leo got a great idea. And there is Leo in his the convertible that's painted pink, and it says Leo's World Famous Scrapyard. Coogie the Dumpster Cat. One warm summer day, a little blue-eyed kitty woke up in an unfamiliar place. It was dark and wet, and it didn't smell very good. This was not where he belonged. The little kitty was hungry and stuck out his tongue. Ick, this place did not taste very good either. Trying to stand, the kitty found that each time he moved, he fell deeper into the dark, wet, stinky place.
"Meow, meow, meow," he cried,
but no one came. Hungry, a little scared, and all alone, the kitty curled up into a ball and tried to fall asleep, hoping that when he woke, he would be somewhere else. Creak, bang! Suddenly, there was a loud noise and a bright light above him.
"Meow!"
he cried again. As he clawed and climbed his way toward the light, two large hands reached down and scooped him up. "Well, hello there, little kitty," said the man with the big hands. "What on earth are you doing in this dumpster?" The little kitty was very happy to be out in the warm sun. He saw trees and grass and felt the wind ruffle his fur. He was so happy, in fact, that he started wiggling his body all around as he purred. "What's this?" the man said with a chuckle. "Are you dancing? You must be happy to get out of this dumpster. Well, get ready to dance some more because I know just where to take you. You're coming with me, and I'll introduce you to Aunt Lenny. She's not really my aunt, but everyone calls her that because she's so nice and finds good homes for lots of animals." The man placed the kitty inside a brown paper bag, but left the top open just a bit so the kitty could see outside. Once again, the kitty was inside a dark place, but he wasn't scared. It was dry, it didn't smell too bad, and there was enough light at the top to make him feel safe. He started purring and soon fell asleep, curled up inside the paper bag. This time, when he woke, two new, soft, and gentle hands reached down into the darkness and pulled him up and out of the bag. The hands belonged to a lady who stood beside the man. "Aunt Lenny, this is the dancing kitty I told you about," the man said, smiling. "Do you think you can find him a home?" Aunt Lenny held the kitty out at arm's length, turning him from side to side. "Oh, what a handsome kitty you are. And look at those beautiful, bright blue eyes," she exclaimed. "I'm sure we will find the perfect home for you." First, Aunt Lenny took the kitty for a checkup to make sure he was in good health. The veterinarian was friendly and careful when she touched him. In fact, she tickled him a bit with her stethoscope, and the kitty meowed and did another silly dance. "Well, he has some personality, this little one," said the vet. "I would guess he was born only a couple of months ago, maybe near the end of March." Next, Aunt Lenny and the kitty stopped at a pet store. "Just a few things for the week while you're staying with me," Aunt Lenny said as she fastened a brand new blue collar around the kitten's neck. He purred and wiggled his happy dance, causing Aunt Linny to smile and do a little dance of her own. When they got home, Aunt Linny fed the kitty and watched him explore her home, purring and wiggling his way around each room. "You need a name," she declared, scooping him up into her arms. "Your beautiful blue eyes and your dancing feet remind me of someone special. And his birthday was in March, too," she said. "I'm going to call you Coogie." That was his nickname. Over the next few days, as Aunt Linny worked to find a loving family for Coogie, she watched as he made himself right at home. His favorite spot was on top of the sofa by the window, where he could watch birds fly by. He took long naps whenever he found a ray of sun, and whenever Aunt Linny was near, he purred and wiggle-danced his way into her lap. This always made her smile. It seemed as though Coogie had a different idea about finding himself a home. He seemed perfectly content to stay right there with Aunt Linny. Maybe he could convince her of that. One morning, Aunt Linny got a call that a new home might be available for Coogie. She found him to tell him the good news. "Coogie, I have found the perfect home for you." Oh, no! Coogie was running out of time. He put his tiny paw up as high as he could on her leg and looked right at her with his big blue eyes as he meowed over and over.
"Meow, meow."
"Coogie, what are you trying to tell me?" asked Aunt Linny. But as she spoke the words, she realized that she didn't want to find Coogie a new home. She wanted him to stay with her. "You and I were meant to be together, Coogie. You may have been found in a dumpster, but now, my little dancing king, you will always have a home with me." Coogie the kitty purred and wiggle-danced right up onto Aunt Linny's lap, where he would happily stay forever. Raven's Ribbons. Raven loves round dances. The rhythm of the drums sounds like hearts racing. The drums sing to the people. The people dance to their songs. Boom, boom, shuffle, shuffle. As soon as Raven hears the drums, he slips his hand into Grandma's and off they go. Together with friends and family, Raven and Grandma sidestep to the rhythm of the drums. Round and round they go. Round and round they go. Raven's favorite part of the round dance is to watch the ribbon skirts. As they sway side to side, Raven imagines he's swirling in a rainbow. Round and round they go. Round and round they go. Women from all over ask Grandma to sew ribbon skirts for them because hers are the most colorful. Grandma says that every ribbon skirt she makes is as beautiful and unique as the person she sews it for. "How do you know which colors of ribbon to use?" asked Raven. "I think of the person I'm sewing the skirt for. Like people, no two skirts are the same." "Nokum, do you think a boy could wear a ribbon skirt?" Grandma squeezes Raven's hand and thinks for a moment. "I've lived for a long time, Nosim, and have never seen a boy in a ribbon skirt." As Raven drifts in his dreams, Grandma sits at her sewing machine. She thinks about all the ribbon skirts that have passed through her hands, of the people who wear them, and the places the skirts have seen. She thinks of all the ribbon colors she matched together. As Grandma sews late into the night, the ribbons begin to dance to the hum of her sewing machine. Round and round they go. Round and round they go. As the sun comes up again, Grandma calls to Raven, pulling him from his dreams. Come, look what this new day has brought. Raven opens his eyes to the most beautiful rainbow, his very own ribbon skirt. I've lived for a long time, Nusum, and I'm lucky to see beautiful things that I've never seen before. At the next round dance, Raven waits for drums to call everyone to the dance floor. The drums sing to the people. The drums dance to their songs. Boom, boom, shuffle, shuffle. When the round dancing starts, Raven slips his hand into Grandma's and off they go. Raven and his rainbow ribbon skirt are first to hit the dance floor. Hand in hand with Grandma, in a swirl of ribbons, all beautiful and unique. Round and round they go. Round and round they go. Raven and his rainbow ribbons leading the way. A Hug on the Wind. When Grandma said she was going away for the winter, Sam was worried. What about the stories Grandma made up just for him? What about their science experiments in Grandma's kitchen? What about making snow forts and reading books and drinking hot chocolate in front of Grandma's fireplace? Grandma held her arms out wide. We can still talk, she said. I can still tell you stories, and I will send you postcards. Sam climbed onto her lap. But what if I need a hug? He asked. You can't send a hug in the mail. I will send a hug on the wind, Grandma said. A hug is as light as air. The wind can carry it for miles and miles and deliver it right to your front door. There might not be any wind where you are, Sam said. What if it's very, very hot and the air is very, very still, and there isn't even a tiny little breeze? Then the sun will be shining brightly, Grandma said, and I will find a golden beam of sunshine that is pointing your way, and I will send my hug right along with it. It might rain here, Sam said. Sometimes it rains for days and days and days, and the sun can't come out at all. Well, then, I will blow my hug up to the softest little cloud in the sky, Grandma said. And that little cloud will float all the way across the ocean, and the raindrops will land on your face like hundreds of tiny kisses. What if it snows? Sam asked. Will the snowflakes be kisses too? They will, Grandma said, and you can lie down in the fluffy white snow, and I'll lie down in the warm white sand, and we will make snow and sand angels together. Sam nodded, and then he thought of something else. What about bedtime? He asked. What about saying good night? Grandma kissed the top of his head. I will tiptoe outside every night and whisper to the fireflies, she said, and they will flutter up into the night sky and disappear like glowing sparks from a fire. And then what? Sam asked. Where will they go? Grandma smiled. At bedtime, when you look out your window and see the stars, they will be twinkling just for you. I love you, Grandma, Sam said. I love you, little one, Grandma said. And I will always be with you, even when we are apart. Thunder Maestro. Yes, a summer storm. I race across my yard in search of just the right stick. It must be long, but not twisty, pointy, but not sharp. Da-da-da-da! Perfecto! I step onto my stage. I nod and point my stick towards the sky. Arms up, the crowd hushes. Slowly now, swish, pump, swish, pump, swish, pump. The clouds mix in, billowy white and misty gray. I start the symphony off, slow and low like a whisper. Rumble, grumble, excitement bubbles inside me. A little bit faster now, swish, pump, swish, pump, swish, pump. The crowd grows larger, so I turn the volume up. Rumble, grumble, groan, growl. What beautiful music. Keep going, the birds sing in the lulls of the storm. Swish, pump, swish, pump, swish, pump. The clouds darken. The wind blows. Rumble, grumble, groan, growl. Whoosh, swoosh. The wisp and rustling of leaves adds to the melody. Swish, pump, swish. Pump, swish, pump. The wind sways the branches of the old pine tree as it creaks to the rhythm. Rumble, grumble, groan, growl, whoosh, swoosh, creak, squeak. My foot taps to the beat. Swish, pump, swish, pump, swish, pump. I sway with the waves of sound and the movement of the air around me. Rumble, grumble, groan, growl, whoosh, whoosh, creak, squeak, tip, tap. I swirl and twirl. Swish, pump, swish, pump, swish, pump. Spray kisses my skin as I dance to the rhythm. Rumble, grumble, groan, growl, whoosh, whoosh, creak, squeak, tip, tap, pitter, patter, splitter, splatter. The crescendo builds. Swish, pump, swish, pump, swish, pump. The music beats inside of me, more quickly now. I move to the safety of inside, but stay in the garden of my imagination. The air around me electrifies and buzzes like a swarm of angry bees. Rumble, grumble, groan, growl, whoosh, swoosh, creak, squeak. Tip, tap, pitter, patter, splitter, splatter, flash. I'm lost in the music. Swish, pump, swish, pump, swish, pump. The ground trembles. Rumble, grumble, groan, growl, whoosh, swoosh, creak, squeak. Tip, tap, pitter, patter, splitter, splatter, clap, snap, boom, kaboom. I shiver. The symphony is complete. My arms droop. The stick dangles in my hand. I inhale and take a bow. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about a month, titled The 57 Bus, a true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. One teenager in a skirt, one teenager with a lighter, one moment that changes both of their lives forever. If it weren't for the 57 bus, Sasha and Richard never would have met. Both were high school students in Oakland, California, one of the most diverse cities in the country. But they inhabited different worlds. Sasha lived in the middle-class foothills and attended a small private school. Richard lived in the economically challenged flatlands and attended a large public one. After school each day, their paths overlapped on the bus for a mere 8 minutes. But one afternoon, a single reckless act left Sasha severely burned, and Richard charged with 2 hate crimes and facing life imprisonment. The case garnered international attention, thrusting both teenagers into the spotlight. But in the 57 bus, author Daishika Slater shows that what might at first seem like a simple matter of right and wrong, justice and injustice, victim and criminal, is something more complicated and far more heartbreaking. This true story, first chronicled in the New York Times Magazine by Slater and artfully, compassionately, and expertly expanded upon here, is a riveting exploration of race, class, gender, identity, morality, and forgiveness, told with honesty and insight gleaned from both teens' lives. The 57 bus will inspire you to rethink all you know about crime, punishment, and empathy. Okay, last week I described Richard. He's black but light-skinned, smiling, joking around, likes attention, likes to play fight, acting young. Richard meets the school's truant officer after school because he's missed a lot of days at school and wants to be in her program. And her name is Caprice Wilson. And we learned about her gang life when she was younger, growing up in East Oakland with gang leader Little Jerry, who was killed in his 20s. And that's where I left off last week. The best mother ever. At Oakland High School, Caprice served as a surrogate mom to the kids who needed one the most, the ones who had trouble just getting to school every day. Some of them, like Cherie, even called her mom, bringing her their grades, photographs, and artwork to hang on her walls, and writing her apologies when they ran into trouble. Her tiny office was papered with their missives. From son Oscar, "I love you, Mom," read one. "I'm sorry, Mom, she made me hecka mad," said another, written by a girl who had just gotten suspended for fighting. Caprice taught her kids to look out for one another, even when their inclination was to squabble. If a student wanted to be one of her children, they had to accept that they were gaining siblings as well as a mother. "We're family," she told them. "This is your sister. This is your brother. You have no say in the matter." On her walls, she posted the family slogan, "Never let your obstacles become more important than your goal." Well, the goals: go to class, get your grades up, graduate, stay out of jail, survive. Her office was a safe zone for Richard. It was the size of a walk-in closet, tucked off a hallway near the main office, but it had a couch where kids could sit and talk, take a breath, regroup, relax. He'd drop in during passing periods just to touch base. He never wanted to get out of her office, Cherie remembers. I mean, he really loved her. Cherie was already one of Caprice's children. Caprice had helped her get off probation the year before, and she had never caught another case. Before long, Richard asked if he could call Caprice Mom too, but she wouldn't let him. He already had a mom he was close to. She wasn't going to try to take that spot. "I'll be your auntie," she told him. Hopes and prayers. Richard's mother, Jasmine, was already 4.5 months pregnant when her grandmother took her to the doctor to get checked. She was 14 years old and had been dating a boy 2 years older. He was the one who figured out she was pregnant. She hadn't known enough to make sense of the changes happening to her body. It was too late for an abortion, but Jasmine figured she was prepared to raise a child. She loved babysitting her niece and nephew. How hard could it be? I thought it was about dressing them up and buying them clothes, she recalled. Richard was born the summer before Jasmine turned 15. She split up with his father 11 months later. Richard still saw him frequently over the years, or as frequently as he could, given that his father was sometimes in prison for drug offenses. When Richard was 5, Jasmine got involved with a new man, Derek. Richard was resentful, still holding out hope that his parents would get back together. "You're not my dad," he told Derek. Being a mother was harder than Jasmine had expected, but she took pains to do it well. Richard's temperament made it easy. He was a happy kid, always dancing and singing, playful and silly. She brought him to church every Sunday, taught him to recite his prayers and say grace before he ate, made sure he held the door open for women and seniors, minded his manners, was helpful around the house. Richard's friends knew his mom ran a tight ship. No disrespect, no talking back. Jasmine had two sisters, Juliette and Savannah, each of whom had children of their own. The three sisters were young and beautiful, with high foreheads, large almond-shaped eyes, and full Cupid bow lips. There was always a lot of laughing when they were together. The kids moved easily among the sisters' houses, cocooned in the warmth of a large extended family. But on December 30th, 2006, when Richard was 9 years old, everything changed. A car parked in San Francisco was sprayed with bullets, killing 3 people inside. Savannah was one of them. She left behind 2 girls, ages 4 and 11. They moved in with Richard, Jasmine, and Derek. Jasmine treated her nieces as daughters, but it was hard on everyone. The girls had lost their mother. Jasmine had lost her sister. And 9-year-old Richard had gone from being the center of his mother's world to just one more traumatized member of a family with a gaping hole in it. "I don't get any attention now," he told his mom. Jasmine tried to explain. "I know how I feel because it was my sister. You know how you feel because it was your auntie. But for them, it was their mom. And I have to share the love, you know, even it out." 2 years later, Jasmine had a baby with Derek. The household now had 6 members, Derek and Jasmine, Richard and his new brother, Darion, plus the 2 girls. They had moved into a 4-bedroom stucco bungalow in the far reaches of East Oakland's Elmhurst neighborhood. The house was pale pink and had rose bushes in the front yard. It was a tough neighborhood, but a quiet street. Jasmine had always hoped to continue her education, but it was a scramble just to get the bills paid and the children cared for and the house scrubbed and neat the way she liked it. No spots on the glass tabletop, no dust in the corners. When Richard was a junior in high school, she was working in food services at a residential care facility. She wanted something better for Richard. "I'm not making that much at my job," she said. "I want him to have a career, go to college." She hadn't saved much, but she figured if she started out at community college, he could transfer to a state school. These were big dreams in her part of town. One of the roughly 600 African-American boys who started Oakland high schools as freshmen each year, only about 300 ended up graduating. fewer than 100 graduated with the requirements needed to attend a California state college or university. The odds of landing in the back of a police cruiser, on the other hand, were much better. African-American boys made up less than 30% of Oakland's underage population, but accounted for nearly 75% of all juvenile arrests. Jasmine worried about Richard, prayed he'd graduate from high school, prayed he wouldn't become a parent as early as she had, prayed he'd be safe from all the dangers that lurked for a young black man in Oakland, guns and crime and gangs and cops. Prayed he'd stayed out of trouble. Prayed he'd survive. Where he left off. Richard brought Caprice his schoolwork to put up on the wall, just like the others did. His grades weren't great, but that wasn't the point. Getting a D was better than getting an F. Next time it'll be a C, she told him. Before long, it'll be a B, and then you'll be making straight A's. When the two of them were alone, he confided in her about his life, replaying things that had happened and explaining how he'd do them differently now. Sometimes he'd tell her about a situation he was struggling with and ask for advice. But most of the time, they weren't alone. Caprice had a lot of other children. When they were in the office, Richard sat and listened to them talk. He would make himself invisible, but he would observe and notice everything, Caprice says. A lot of times, students would come in here, and he was like their little counselor. He would help them get through whatever was going on. He wanted people to be happy. That was the thing everybody noticed about him. He was always joking, goofing around. Caprice had a toy basketball hoop on her door to give her students, younger siblings, something to do when their parents came in for meetings. She usually kept it pinned up so the bigger kids wouldn't use it, because when they did things, tended to get out of hand. Richard would shoot balled up paper through it on the sly, making sure Caprice noticed. Did you see that bird, Miss Caprice? In the mood in the room was tense. He might suddenly pull his pants up high above his waist like a nerd to get people giggling. There's already enough craziness, he told Caprice. I just like happy stuff. That's how everyone knew Richard, as the funny one, the one who made people smile. He pulled pranks, like putting ketchup on people's faces while they slept, or ambushing them with water balloons when they'd just woken up. He would do anything for a laugh. Put on one of his female cousin's sexy crop sweaters, for example, or post a selfie on Instagram of himself dressed in a bra and a wig, gazing into the bathroom mirror with a sultry expression. I'm a thought for Halloween, the caption explained. That fall, Jasmine was planning a trip to Disneyland. You might not have fun because you are a big kid, she told Richard. That wouldn't be a problem, he assured her. I'm going to have fun like I'm 5 years old. He'd lost a year of his childhood, his cousin Gerald pointed out later. He'd only just come back after being sent away. He didn't really get to experience the fun time. He's probably like living from where he left off. How it was before. Sometimes when Cherie thinks about her old friends, her eyes fill up with tears. I'm not going to say we were angels, she says. I'm not going to say we were scholars. But we all had good hearts. We looked out for each other because that was all we knew. She was talking about 2012, the year she and Richard were freshmen in high school, before everything went bad. In those days, they cut school on the daily, heading to the intersection of Fruitvale Avenue and MacArthur Boulevard, where kids gathered from all over town in the afternoons to talk and flirt and play dice, occasionally to fight. They had a crew they called the Heartbreak Kids, not a gang, but a play gang, a set of initials to write down in jagged letters, HBK. They went bowling, they went to the beach, they rode the bus all over town, stopping in at high schools where they didn't even go to school, just to visit whoever might be hanging around the halls. They knew everyone, it seemed everyone from the east side anyway, but they loved one another best. They had grown up together, and now they were in high school, full of sass and fire. Skeet and Ashley were the oldest at 16. Jesse was 15. Cherie, Hadri, and Day were 14. So was Richard, though he seemed younger. Skeet used to take up for him, Cherie remembered. Richard was like a little brother. He was the youngest one, him and Hadri. But Hadri, he brave-hearted. He didn't take too much from nobody. But Richard, like everybody, just watch him. Richard's hecka goofy and hecka obnoxious and would do something stupid. He would do the craziest stuff. Back then, they had their whole lives ahead of them, or so they thought. It wasn't supposed to turn out like it did, which is why the tears keep leaking from her eyes as she talks. She never dreamed it would turn out like it did. Because at the time, they were beautiful. They were young, and they had one another. And it was fun. Not gonna lie, in those days, it was hecka fun. Fighting. They wanted to go to the beach. It wasn't particularly warm, maybe 70 degrees, if that. But they were bored, and so they went. Richard, Cherie, Day, Skeet, Hadri, Jesse, and Ashley. All of them on the bus to the beach. It was April 2012. The way Cherie remembers it, they got off at Fruitvale to chase buses. But Ashley wasn't paying attention. Ashley, come on, Ashley! We finna miss the bus! Turns out there was another girl on the bus named Ashley. She and her friend got off the bus behind them. Why y'all following us? Ashley demanded. What y'all want? That was just what they did in those days. Argued. Now Ashley and other Ashley were arguing, and Day was arguing with other Ashley's friend. Come on, Cherie called. They don't want no problems. The argument seemed pointless to her, stupid. They were trying to get to the beach. But then, according to Cherie, Ashley hit other Ashley, and the fight began for real. Cherie tried to break it up and got hit, so she hit back. Then Richard tried to break it up, but he got hit too. In the tussle that followed, something fell out of other Ashley's bag, insulin and needles. Richard picked them up and tried to hand them to her, but she threw them at him, and so they all just took off, laughing and breathless. She was so hyper. Why'd she have all them needles? She must have diabetes. I tried to give it back to her. Oh, well. They ended up in a park, Cherie remembers. Scrubby grass, a soccer field, tennis courts. There were some Latino kids there, skateboarders. How the boys ended up fighting them was a mystery to Cherie, but that's what happened. Somebody spoke to somebody wrong, and then Skeet and Hadri were fighting, and Richard joined in because if his friends were fighting, he'd fight too. Skeet hit one of the kids with a skateboard. It was heck a savage, Cherie said later. Then they went to the beach, ran around in the sand, talked about what had happened, partied, adrenaline pumping, laughing, bleeding a little. On the way home, the bus went down Fruitvale. Looking through the windows, they saw the girls they'd fought with and the skateboarders from the park. Look, there they are. They're talking to the police. Then a cruiser pulled up behind the bus. Arrested. We were just young, Cherie explained. We didn't even think we could go to jail for it. Honestly, we didn't think about jail when it happened. But the law didn't see it that way. The police arrested Richard, Cherie, Day, Skeet, Hadri, and Ashley. Jesse had already gotten off the bus by then, so he got away. The rest of them kept waiting to go home, but they weren't allowed to go home. Juvenile records are sealed, so it's impossible to reconstruct exactly what went down. But it appears that the skateboarder said some of their stuff was missing, including a cell phone. Nothing was found on Richard and his friends, but charges were brought. Sometime after midnight, they were booked into Juvenile Hall. That's where they stayed, distributed across separate units. Juvenile Hall policy doesn't let kids who are arrested together stay together. Both. So they don't have a chance to compare stories and to keep them from getting into any more trouble. At the first time they went to court for a detention hearing, Richard got all goofy, excited to be reunited with his friends, sure that when the court appearance was over, they would get to go home. But that's not what happened. There's no bail for juvenile offenders. It's up to the judge to decide whether to let you go home or keep you in custody. When there's violence involved, they tend to keep you. Hadri had known. He was the only one of them who'd ever been arrested before. He said, "We're not getting out of jail. Don't even think that." And he was right. Cherie recalls that they were in custody for a time, and then, one by one, they went their separate ways. Cherie got out on probation, a GPS moniker on her ankle. Skeet and Hadri were sentenced to out-of-home placement and sent to group homes, where they would have to complete formal treatment programs before returning to their families. Richard was released on GPS early on, but eventually he was sentenced to a group home in Redding, California, a 3.5-hour drive from Oakland. He would stay there until the following summer, more than a year after his arrest. The six kids would never all be together again. After that, everything went wrong instead of right. Now it's a good day. Skeet was an extrovert, a goofball, a practical joker. People remembered him after they met him. They remembered his quick wit, his energy, his magnetism, his loyalty, and, if they got on the wrong side of it, his temper. He was the one who could do a backflip off a traffic barrier, the one who sauntered on and off the debate team at Skyline High School, sometimes showing up, sometimes not, but always quick on his feet, leading with his wit and his gift of gab, even if he couldn't be bothered with the preparation. Skeet was sent to Boys Republic, a residential treatment facility for troubled youths in Chino Hills, California. It's not clear how long he was supposed to stay there, but he ran away and returned to Oakland long before his time was up. On November 26, 2012, he posted a sepia-toned photo of himself on Facebook. He was sitting in a car, head tilted back to look down at the camera, his eyes hooded. He had a gun in his right hand. "What is that?" someone queried. Trey 8, Skeet wrote, meaning that it was a 38 caliber revolver. But this old B4, I went to jail. "You out for good?" To myself, yeah, but to the police, they want a nigga. He ran away from the group home and was back in Oakland. The day before he posted the gun photo, he'd posted a photo of himself with a bottle of cognac and a bottle of cough syrup. "Got my syrup and my Remy. Now it's a good day." Now he posted a picture of himself drinking straight from the bottle. Big boy drinking. That was his last Facebook post. On the afternoon of January 7, 2013, more than a month after running away from the group home, he was shot multiple times while driving a car near Hengsberger Road and Hamilton Street. He was 17 years old. The man police blamed for his murder was killed 4 days later in an outbreak of violence that left 4 people dead in 1 6-hour period. When Richard heard about his friend's death, he called his mother from the group home in Reading to find out if it was true. When she said it was, he began to cry and couldn't stop. He didn't even hang up, just put the phone down and walked away. If. Everything turned dark then. Skeet dead. Skeet dead. Skeet dead. That killed Richard, Cherie said later. It killed all of us. She didn't have an explanation for his murder, except the usual. Wrong place, wrong time, wrong company. And unfortunately, that's where I might have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The 57 Bus. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.